Jo. Thanks very much to the organisers again. This has been a really fun and interesting workshop for me. So I realise this is a mystery talk which had no title on the programme because I was very undecided as to what I was going to talk about. The other topic that I was thinking about talking about was dark matter bound states that are a little bit more complicated than dark positronium. So if you want to know more about that, feel free to ask me. But yeah, today is sort of the after-dinner mints of the conference. I'm going to talk about some work that I did with my student Hongwen Liu, my fantastic postdoc Wei Zhiwei, who's going to CERN last year, and our other collaborators Jim Klein, Joachim Kopp, Jia Liu, and Xiaoping Wang. So there's been a lot of discussion at this workshop about light dark matter, probing new ways to probe dark matter below the GV scale, and also I've heard discussion in the lunches and about and the coffee breaks about what you can do with light dark matter, what the challenges are for light dark matter. So I wanted to tell you about a couple of ideas that we had for natural ways to get light thermorelic dark matter and what the implications of those models are. Okay, but so let me first begin, before I give the outline for my talk, by just setting the scene a bit. We've seen plots like this before at this meeting. So when we think about the mass scale of dark matter, we have our traditional WIMP window around the GV to TeV scale. We've said that above about 100 TeV, if dark matter is to be point-like and still a thermal relic, then the cosmology needs to be non-standard. You need other non-trivial ingredients just due to the unitarity bound. And the other end of this is that if dark matter is lighter than about an MeV, then that means that if it's thermal, if it's at a similar temperature to the standard model, it will still be relativistic or close to relativistic around BBN. And it can be constrained just by counting the number of effective degrees of freedom. Now, of course, you can have non-thermal dark matter. You can go far below the MeV scale. You can think about axions, about light, cold, dark photons. And that's fine. But what I wanted, but there's still this interesting range between about an MeV and a GeV scale where dark matter can, in principle, should be able to be a thermorelic without having to do anything particularly special to the cosmology. And this has been proposed as essentially a new lamppost, a new window like a WIMP window where we have a predictive target for interactions between the dark matter and the standard model. So by thermal dark matter, what I mean is dark matter that at some point in its history was in thermal equilibrium with the standard model. We talk about a thermal relic, we mean additionally that the abundance of the dark matter is set by its annihilation rate in the early universe. So this is the same as the WIMP scenario. We're just getting rid of the has to be weakly interacting, where by weakly we mean standard model electroweak gauge bosons. So, and this has the same advantage that the WIMP scenario does, that if the annihilation is to standard model particles, that tells us that we have some minimal needed bound on dark matter standard model couplings, which is highly predictive. And so thus you get plots like this one on the right, which is taken from the Cosmic Visions 2017 report, and I think credited to Gordon Krinchek, who's here in this room, where there's a single parameter that governs the annihilation for a range of different dark matter possibilities, scalars, Majorana fermions, Pseudo-Dirac fermions. You can then say, okay, how would I go look for this at a terrestrial, how would I look for this at a collider experiment? How would this show up in terrestrial experiments? So this looks very nice, but there are some challenges. Just because the scenario is so predictive, it's also quite constrained. So the first constraint is sort of a theory issue, which is just that it's not completely trivial to get the cross-section right. The WIMP miracle starts to get a little bit stretched as you move away from the WIMP window. If you say I have some light dark sector, everything in is at the same scale, and the annihilation cross-section is set by that mass scale, then that tells you that you need rather small coupling. Then your scaling is alpha squared over m squared. That tells you that you need rather small couplings to get the right relic density. Alternatively, if you've got light dark matter, if you think that, okay, I've got my light dark matter, but it's interacting with the standard model through weak scale mediators or something heavier that we haven't found at the LHC, then that requires rather largish couplings. So this is the Lee-Weinberg bound. It's just saying if you interact through weak scale couplings, so if you interact through weak scale gauge bosons and through weak scale couplings, then your dark matter had better not be lighter than about the GeV scale. So there are ways to evade both of these. Maybe you just have a small coupling, maybe you have new light mediators, but then you run into other more phenomenological constraints, which is that if you have the right cross-section to match the present-day observed relic abundance, and you assume, all right, we're just looking at the simplest possible operator, we're looking at S-wave annihilation with no velocity suppression, then that annihilation will continue in the late universe and impact other observables. So in particular, these are constraints on the cross-section for dark matter annihilating into electrons or photons as a function of dark matter mass from measurements of the cosmic microwave background. So this is from looking at the effects of those injected electrons or photons on the ionization level of the universe at early times. And this constraint gets stronger for lower dark masses just because the dark matter number density gets higher for lower dark matter masses. And essentially, you see, so this is roughly the limit, that essentially for dark matter masses at a GeV, the cross-section should be less than about 10 to the minus 27 centimeters cubed per second. As you go to lower masses, this constraint gets roughly linearly stronger. So everything above this line is ruled out. The standard thermorelic cross-section for the WIMP picture is about 3 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. Now, there are ways to get around this. A classic way to get around this is to say, OK, well, maybe your dominant annihilation cross-section during freeze-out is P-wave suppressed. It has a V-squared suppression. Or maybe it's not. You can move away from the pure thermorelic picture and say maybe it's not the annihilation cross-section that's setting the abundance at all. Maybe there's some asymmetry in the dark sector. And then there are models that I'll talk a bit more about in this talk, which are SIMPs, where three-body or higher annihilation governs the freeze-out, and so you have a stronger density scaling at late times or forbidden dark matter, which I'll talk about in more detail. So in this talk, I want to talk about two ways of addressing these challenges. I want to show you two parameter regimes that naturally yield fairly light thermorelic dark matter with couplings around the electroweak coupling in dark sectors that don't have multiple scales that you need to tune against each other. Everything's around the same mass, and they ignore or severely modify these indirect detection limits. That's going to be based on the two papers that I had on the initial slide. The first one has the slightly unfortunate name of not forbidden dark matter, but it will make sense when we get to this point. I voted for a different name, but was outvoted. What happens here is the three-body annihilations dominate freeze-out. This has come up in models of SIMPs, strongly interacting massive particles. I'm going to show you that this is actually a natural region of parameter space for just the simplest dark photon models, weak couplings, and yet these three-body annihilations, which we normally neglect, can be important. And the second region I want to talk about is models called impeded dark matter, where you have small mass splittings between the dark matter particles and what they're annihilating to, and thus the phase space suppression can give rise to both suppressed annihilation cross-sections and novel scalings with velocity. Okay, so let me first just say a little bit about dark photons. For I realize that half the room spends a lot of their time thinking about dark photons, so for you it will be a refresher. For those who don't, so the picture here, this is a very simple model of an added dark sector. We say the dark photon's a gauge boson of a new U1 dark gauge symmetry. This allows a dimension 4 mixing between the dark photon, the dark photon kinetic term, and the ordinary standard model photon kinetic term. So this is very predictive. The dark photon just couples to everything that the standard model photon does, but with a mixing that is suppressed by epsilon. We'll then say, OK, let's imagine a dark sector where the dark matter is charged under this dark U1. Most of the diagrams I'm drawing are going to be assuming that this is a fermion. That's not completely essential. It could be something else. So the standard law for these dark photon scenarios is that there are two regimes that you need to worry about. Regime one is where the dark matter is lighter than the dark photon. So the dark photon is not a stable particle. The dark photon, at least for the masses that I'm talking about around the GeV scale, the dark photon can decay on fairly short timescales through its mixing with the standard model photon. So it can decay in any charged standard model particles that are lighter than its mass, which in the MeV to GeV scale mostly means electrons. So the standard law is, okay, case one is the dark matter really is the lightest thing in the my inequality signs are the wrong way around here. I thought I checked. Okay, I fixed this and they evidently fixed it in the wrong direction. Okay, so mentally reversing the inequality signs. Case one is where the dark matter mass is heavier than the dark H boson mass, in which case we can just have annihilation. This is just like positron annihilation into two photons. The dark matter can annihilate directly to two dark photons. Those dark photons, those on-shell dark photons, will at some later time decay. So the freeze-out in this case is entirely set by couplings in the dark sector. It has very little to do with this mixing to the standard model. This just sets the decay lifetime. The other case is where the dark photon mass is less, is where the dark photon mass is heavier than the dark matter mass. In that case, we say, okay, this channel is kinematically forbidden. It can't occur. So instead, the leading order annihilation process will be through this, will require this mixing with the standard model. It will be epsilon squared suppressed. This can naturally be a very small coupling. And it will just produce standard model particles directly. So in this second case, we're essentially integrating out the dark photon for purposes of dark matter annihilation. This is just like the dark matter talks directly to the standard model, but with a naturally small coupling. So it was pointed out by Raffaele, Tito D'Agnolo, and Josh Ruderman back in 2015 that actually it can be a little bit more complicated than this. If epsilon is small, you can have a case where even though the dark matter is lighter than the dark H boson, this annihilation process can still be important compared to the annihilations that are suppressed by the small coupling, because while this process is kinematically forbidden, if the dark matter particles are at zero velocity, the dark matter particles are not at zero velocity, especially during freeze-out. So the impeded scenario, which I'll talk about later, is similar to this, except the mass splittings are small enough that this kinematic suppression is just not very strong during freeze-out. But the original forbidden dark matter scenario said, well, okay, what if there's an order one splitting between the dark matter mass and the dark photon mass? That means that dark matter can annihilate into dark photons, but it will need a significant amount of kinetic energy to do so. So this means that the cross section will be somewhat suppressed during freeze out, when the typical energy of the dark matter particles is 5 to 10% of their mass, but it will be extremely strongly suppressed at late times. So you can essentially kill all the CMB signatures. The dark matter is moving very slowly. There's a very strong suppression here. So they showed here, this is for two different couplings, alpha of 0.1 and 0.01, how as you vary this mass splitting, the relic density changes, and this dotted line is the relic density that you want. And so you can see that, and the red lines are for 1 MeV dark matter, and the blue lines for 1 GeV dark matter. And you can see that what happens in this case is, for these couplings around the weak scale coupling, when this splitting is order one, you naturally get the right relic density and you eliminate those indirect detection constraints that I was talking about earlier. So the first thing I want to talk about is that this is absolutely true if the only competing channels that you consider are the kinematically forbidden 2 to 2 annihilation into dark photons and the epsilon squared suppressed annihilation directly into standard model particles. But there are other possible annihilation channels in the dark sector. So here are some schematic diagrams here's a schematic diagram for one of them. We could draw this diagram where 3 dark matter particles enter and 1 dark matter particle and 1 dark photon leaves. So this process is available and not kinematically suppressed at all if the dark matter is lighter than the dark photon, it's lighter than the dark photon, but the dark photon is lighter than twice the dark matter mass. In this scenario, these processes being not kinematically suppressed and not suppressed by a small coupling can actually dominate the freeze-out. So how do we proceed in this case? We need to solve the Boltzmann equations as usual. In the simplest case, you might say, all right, we'll just assume that the dark photons stay in thermal equilibrium with the standard model, but that's not always a good assumption for the parameter regions that we'll be looking at. So you need to simultaneously solve for the dark matter density and the evolution of the dark matter density and the evolution of the dark photon density. I do not expect you to read all the terms in these codes, but these are basically just including terms for the three-body dark matter annihilation into dark matter and dark photon. The fact that the dark photons can annihilate back to give you dark matter particles, you need to take that into account. And the dark photons can decay into standard model particles with some lifetime. There's something interesting about the cosmology in this scenario, which I didn't fully appreciate until we wrote this paper. So here, there are two functions that we're solving. There are two quantities that we're solving for, which are the number density of the dark matter and the number density of the dark photon. So we've got two unknowns, we've got two equations. This is fine. So, but one simplified way that you can think about this is if some of these processes are much, much faster than a Hubble time, then essentially the effect of this equation is to drive their coefficient to be small. There are two functions to solve for here, and chi n and a prime. That means that the two fastest processes tend to dominate the evolution equations. The fastest process will enforce, so for example, if this is the fastest process, it will enforce the relation that this combination of densities is small. So it'll enforce some relationship between the number density of the dark matter particles and the number density of the A primes. If there's a second process, which is also very fast, then it'll give you, okay, there's one unique solution to this equation, that one unique solution will be everything is in equilibrium. So freeze-out departures from equilibrium tend to begin when the second fastest process here becomes slow compared to the Hubble rate. So the classic freeze-out scenario, these two processes are, well, the decay of A prime or something else that keeps A prime in equilibrium with the standard model is very fast. You just assume that A prime, or the equivalent of the photon bath, is in thermal equilibrium all the time, and the freeze-out of Encke is set by the second fastest process, which is the two-body annihilation. So in this non-forbidden scenario, you have a somewhat richer available space. Either the decay of the A prime and the 3-2 annihilations can be what controls freeze-out, or if the decay has a long lifetime, then some mixture of the 2-2 and 3 annihilations can be what controls freeze-out. And so there's some range of cosmological scenarios. We can ask generally, so I've been a bit cavalier here. I've said, well, the 3-2 should dominate because it's not kinematically suppressed. But the reason why we normally ignore 3-2 and higher body annihilations is that it scales like a higher power of the density. Here we're talking about the densities of particles that are freezing out. Those densities are Boltzmann suppressed. That is the same exponential suppression that you have in the forbidden channel. I mean, at least in the sense that they're both exponential. So which of these exponential suppressions wins out? Well, we can just count powers. We can just essentially count powers here. So for the three-body annihilation to chi A prime, we look at how many of these annihilations occur per unit time per chi particle. So this gives us a rate like this. This should scale. So the number density in equilibrium, I'm only keeping track of the exponential factors here, not the power law factors. You can be a bit more accurate and keep track of the power law factors as well. But it's Boltzmann suppressed by e to the minus m over t. So there are three dark matter particles in the interaction. One of them is the test dark matter particle we're looking at. Its rate of scattering on two other dark matter particles goes like e to the minus 2m over t. Now, if we look at the Boltzmann suppressed rate from chi bar chi to a prime, we can rewrite this in terms of the unsuppressed rate from a prime to chi bar chi, just using detailed balance. And so that gives us an expression for this unsuppressed rate in terms of the equilibrium densities of the A prime and the chi. And so we see that this process, we can write as scaling like 2m A prime minus m chi over t. The minus m chi comes because we're looking at what we're interested in is the rate of this process per chi particle. So just comparing these two exponential scalings to each other, we see that the critical point is where A prime is 1.5 times m chi. So where the mass of the A prime is larger than 1.5 times m chi, the three-body annihilations will generally dominate. Below that, the two-body annihilations will generally dominate. I mean, I haven't said anything about what these cross-sections are. They could be of fairly different sizes, but as freeze-out proceeds, this exponential suppression will tend to win over any initial differences in the cross-section. Okay, so let's look at a point in this parameter space and just see and see what happens, see how the freeze-out proceeds. So here, we have these three processes that I mentioned. We have the A prime is connected to the standard model via its decay in the standard model particles and the inverse decays. We have this kinematically suppressed 2-to-2 annihilation channel, and we have this suppressed by the low densities of the particles involved 3-to-2 channel. Other processes as well, which are included in the Boltzmann equations, but these three are really what governs the freeze-out. So here, it turns out that this is the relative rate of these three processes at the time of freeze-out. 3-to-2 is fastest, then decay, then 2-to-2 annihilation. So it's mostly these two that govern the freeze-out process. So this is showing the abundance of the dark matter, the N over normalizes the entropy density as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle over time. So just for calibration, here with these, this is a pretty large alpha. This is alpha prime equals 1. This is like 300 MeV particle. So if we just put in these same, parameters, and we asked what would the freeze-out be, including only the 2-to-2 processes, then we would follow this. Then we would follow this line. This is also including the processes with 2-to-2 annihilation of the standard model particles. What actually happens is that we follow this dark red line and get a relic density that is about 2.5 orders of magnitude lower. That's the importance of including these three to two processes. This purple line is showing what happens to the number density of A prime. So it doesn't stay in equilibrium either. It's freezing. It's also freezing out at a similar time to the chi that is freezing out due to their similar masses. So what happens here is essentially first the A prime abundance starts to deviate from its equilibrium value. That higher A prime abundance drives this slow extended freeze out of the chi prime of the dark matter.
What's the lifetime of A prime?
So it well. I, it's so I mean the, it's com, it's comparable to the Hubble time at this point, right? I mean that's yeah. So it so the rate is comparable to Hubble at this point. So this is x equals m chi over t, m chi is 0.3 GeV. So this is happening down around the like tens of MeV of scale. So yeah, you can also say, okay, what happens if I just assume? You can also do the case where if you dial up epsilon, then multiple things happen. If you dial up epsilon, then it will decay much faster, and so the inverse decays will stay in equilibrium. Yeah. So let me show you. Yeah. So let me show you the exclusion limits, and. Show you the exclusion limits on the slide after this, because yeah. So this slide just summarizes what relic density we obtain in models like this. So this is dark matter mass on the x-axis, the ratio of the dark photon mass to the dark matter mass on the y-axis, and the different colored lines are for different values of alpha, the different dashed and dotted lines are for different values of epsilon. So this region, where r is less than 1.5, is the forbidden dark matter region. There's this very strong scaling with the ratio of the dark matter mass to the dark photon mass. This is due to the exponential suppression in the cross section. But what happens above the NFDM threshold is that suddenly the dependence on r becomes much more mild because now we have these non-kinematically suppressed terms that are present. And so this is more like the standard thermorelic scenario where you don't care in great detail about the masses of the particles involved, except now the appropriate alphas for 1 to MeV to 1 GeV dark matter are in the electroweak region.
I forgot why is it shaped like this?
So what I told you was the explanation of why it goes sharp here and then straight up here, but it curves over. So there's the 3-2 cross section has a resonance as you go to r equals 2. So as you go to r equals 2, just that, you know, the bits that I was ignoring before when I said, okay, I'm only going to look at the exponential pieces, that cross section becomes large, and so you need a higher mass to get the right relative density. Yeah, so this curve is just because that sigma b is getting large. So that's sigma b does have a dependence on r. So that's mostly what's driving that turn back. The changes in epsilon are basically a question of does the a prime decay rapidly or not? Does the a prime stay in equilibrium, or does the a prime diverge from equilibrium and have a higher than equilibrium density? If so, that applies the free sound. So constraints. So this is as you saw on the last slide, this is perfectly fine to get the right relic density for order electro weak couplings for MeV to GeV dark matter. But because we invoked a dark photon model, there are pretty significant constraints. And we said the dark photon mass needs to be close to the dark matter mass. There are pretty substantial constraints on the dark photon mass down at this below 100 MeV scale. So just going to point out a few constraints here. The CMB constraints that I pointed out before that are that are quite dangerous for S-wave annihilation. So now they're this green band. They're being driven. The three-body annihilation is completely negligible during the CMB epoch. So these CMB constraints are being driven entirely by annihilation to standard model particles. That's why they depend on epsilon. So that's this green band here. Direct detection currently is up here. Super CDMS is going to start cutting down into the GeV region. We use some estimates for other direct searches. But the strongest limits on this parameter space at low mass are coming from the fact that we invoked a dark photon model. They're probing the presence of that light state in the spectrum, not the dark matter. Now, for epsilons greater than about 10 to the minus 7, the dark sector stays in kinetic equilibrium with the visible sector throughout this process. So if we're up in this region, so there's a constraint from dark matter self interactions in this model. That is significant. We need to be on the right hand side of this purple line, and in this region here, you have self interaction cross sections that the 0.1 to 1 centimeter squared per gram level that could potentially have interesting effects on the structure of dwarf galaxies. So this is for a particular choice of MA prime over M chi. I can show you the similar plots for different values of this ratio, but the picture is essentially the same. This strongly alleviates indirect detection constraints. It picks out a region of parameter space, sort of the 100 MeV to GeV region, that can potentially have interesting sized self-interactions. Going below 100 MeV is hard if you have a dark photon with an appreciable coupling to the standard model, not because of anything to do with the three-body annihilation, but just because dark photons with that coupling to the standard model are constrained.
So if you add the perspective, you added some perspectives, right, like graphene or super CDMS, if you add what people discuss, like SHIP or Seacrest, it should push from below, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Why is the self-interaction constraint of bank? I thought it's
So the constraint is beyond this side of the lower line.
Oh.
The band is down here the self-interaction cross section is too large.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. On this side, so in the band, the self-interaction cross section is not ruled out and at a level where you could potentially affect the small scale structure in dwarfs and crank clusters. If you think that that's not baryonic physics,
yeah,
is the preferred band.
Sure.
So I'll just mention, so there's another possible region where this can work, which is turn down the coupling epsilon to the standard model, forget about the decays of this. Now, this model you need to do somewhat more work, because if the dark sector is completely secluded from the standard model, it doesn't have any way to dump entropy back into the standard model. If it only has annihilations within the dark sector, it heats up because the entropy from the annihilation is just going to heating back up the dark matter and the dark photon. So the easiest way to do this is to add some light species, some radiation species in the dark sector. However, in that case, you have to make sure that annihilation into this radiation species does not dominate over these suppressed channels that we're dealing with here, which is doable, but it takes a little more model building work. So I'm just going to mention this briefly, but this is what the lines of relic density look like for the secluded case. Again, for MeV to 100 MeV dark matter, you get the right relic density with modest couplings. And here the freeze out is determined by the interplay of the 3-2 and 2-2 processes. Okay, so that's more or less what I wanted to say about forbidden dark matter. So now I want to say a little bit about the impeded dark matter scenario. So this is similar to the forbidden and unforbidden scenarios that I was just talking about, except that you dial the mass splittings way down. So as a consequence, the mass splittings do not have much effect during freeze-out, but they can have a big effect on the indirect detection cross-section at late times. Now, this is, in a sense, more fine-tuned than the other models. The forbidden and not-forbidden cases just require that the dark matter and its annihilation products are of the same order, which is very natural if their masses are coming from the same scale, same way that the W and the Z and the Higgs are all of comparable masses, it's coming from the same physics. So scenarios aren't particularly fine-tuned. In these impeded scenarios, we want a small splitting. So what phenomenology do you have if the dark matter and its annihilation products are close in mass? Well, let's just define this quantity delta as the difference between the dark matter mass minus the mass of whatever it's annihilating to. So you have two cases. Delta is negative. This is the forbidden case. The dark matter is lighter than what it's annihilating to. So the annihilation is going to be exponentially suppressed below a characteristic velocity scale, depending on what you choose this mass splitting to be. That scale can be during freeze-out, as it is for forbidden dark matter. As you make the mass splitting smaller and smaller, this allows you to essentially turn off indirect detection below a certain scale. If this mass splitting is positive, on the other hand, then the dark matter is just slightly heavier than what it's annihilating into, the annihilation will never be forbidden, but the annihilation products are produced essentially at rest. That means that you get a velocity-dependent suppression to the right. Calculations very simple. You can give it to your high school students, undergrad students. But I figured I would just spell this out because occasionally I've been asked the question, so why is sigma V constant for the simplest annihilation processes? Sigma is constant for the simplest scattering processes. It's just phase space. So this is how the cross-section scales. If the matrix element is just a scalar, it's the momentum out divided by the momentum in with an overall factor of 1 over S, the total center of mass energy. So if we've got non-relativistic dark matter particles coming in, so P in goes like M times V, P out by energy conservation is this quantity. If the dark matter is non-relativistic, we can expand this like this. If the dark matter and the X mass are very close to each other, one of these factors is very small, and in that approximation that the dark matter is non-relativistic and that the dark matter mass is close to the X mass, we get this result. So this is just like scattering. This is just like dark matter scattering or dark matter nucleon scattering, that the particles that come out are of similar mass to the particles that go in. As a result, where this mass splitting is small relative to the velocity of the particles, then sigma is approximately constant. Sigma V scales like B. In the limit where that's not true, well, then it depends on the sign. Then what happens depends on the sign of delta. So in this impeded dark matter case, in this intermediate regime, where MVRL squared is large compared to the mass splitting, so the kinetic energy is much higher than the mass splitting, then the behavior doesn't really depend on the sign of delta, but the effect of this small mass splitting is that sigma V, the annihilation cross-section, scales like a scattering cross-section. It just scales like the relative velocity between the dark matter particles. So this is like p-wave annihilation, but the velocity dependence is more mild. P-wave annihilation scales like b squared. So it has similar effects to p-wave annihilation. You suppress, you generically suppress indirect detection signals from regions where the dark matter velocity is very small, such as the CMB or dwarf galaxies. You'll see bigger signals from regions where the dark matter velocity is large, like clusters. Once the kinetic energy drops past this threshold and actually becomes small relative to the mass splitting, then the behavior depends on the sign of delta. If delta is negative, you just switch off the annihilation altogether. It becomes exponentially suppressed, kinematically forbidden. If delta is positive, it goes back to a constant, so it behaves just like S-wave annihilation again, but at a much smaller value than you would have naively expected due to this suppression. So if you want it, so that's the basic idea. It's very simple. So you can write down example models for this. You can just look at examples from the standard model of where do we get particles that are similar in mass to each other. So the two examples that we wrote up in our paper, which I'll encourage you to look at if you're interested, was you can say, okay, we have gauge bosons, their masses are connected by some residual symmetry after we break the overall symmetry. And the other example that we used was charged in neutral pions. So this is a summary of the two models where you have we looked at a dark sector which had a dark SU2, the dark matter and its partners that annihilate two were the dark gauge bosons of this dark SU2. And the other case we looked at was a dark pion case where the dark matter is effectively the charged pions of the dark sector and they can annihilate into the slightly lighter neutral pion. So, and this just summarizes, so in the CMB, in this case, where the dark matter is annihilating something heavier than itself, you completely switch off the signal in galaxies and clusters. The signal just scales like VREL. And then in the dark pion case, delta has the opposite direction. So all low velocity searches just see the same velocity independent cross section. It's just suppressed. So this is the. Go through the model. I mean, I'm happy to talk about this in more detail to anyone who's interested, but this is the dark gauge boson model. It's just the three component of the dark SU2 gauge bosons mixes with the standard model, gamma and z. Due to that mixing, it gets a small mass correction, which is given by this formula. It makes it slightly heavier than the other gauge bosons that don't talk to the standard model. It can also decay through its mixing with the standard model particles. So the dark matter is slightly lighter than its annihilation product. We have another, so the only unsuppressed annihilation channel is from these dark matter gauge bosons into the unstable gauge bosons. This is this process shown at the top. This is dominant during freeze out. It becomes negligible by the epoch of the CMB. And then we have these other possibilities where part of the decay involves the mixing of the K3 with the standard model photon. There's a dark Higgs in this sector to break the symmetry. If the dark Higgs is light enough, it may also be involved in these decays. So where you end up here is if you ask, okay, how do indirect detection experiments compare to the parameters that give you the correct relic density here? The result for that is this plot on the right. This black line shows the combination of coupling in the dark sector and mass of the gauge bosons that you need to get the right relic density. And I mean, you see that the constraints from dwarfs, which previously ruled out dark matter, so I didn't mention the dwarfs in detail, but they're stronger than the CMB for channels that are not purely leptonic. The CMB bounds essentially go away completely. The dwarf galaxy bounds are not constraining in the sub-GB regime. Of course, again, because we're invoking a dark photon kinetically mixed with the standard model photon, this is again an example of complementarity. Switch off the indirect detection, you still get very meaningful constraints on the parameter space from searching for other particles in the dark sector. So this is a standard dark photon mixing plot. These vertical lines are showing what kinds of couplings you need to do freeze out correctly. And again, you see that below about 10 to 100 MeV, it's just hard to accommodate the dark photon in this scenario. But you can go down to masses in the 10 to 100 MeV range.
What
without. The purple thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. This is a measurement of the diffuse gamma ray background.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, diffuse X-ray and gamma ray background. Yeah.
Wait, so even though the scalar in this case is heavier, I would generically expect there to be some Higgs mixing, and so wouldn't they just decay then?
Yeah, okay, good. So, what's the decay you're worried about? I mean, like, yes, the heavier scalar, depending on how heavy it is, could absolutely have signatures as well, which I'm not including.
Oh, I'm imagining take the lightest gauge boson, the dark matter candidate, going to two off-shell scalars, and then those are mixing with the Higgs.
Okay, so...
Because I could always write down a mixed quartic.
Yeah. So, right. You can always write down a Higgs bottle interaction. So how does the DM get stabilized here? Let me get back to you on this because I mean of course. I can make the Higgs heavier and I can make the coefficient of that Higgs bottle term small, but I don't remember offhand if there's a better, like if there's a better reason than that, if there's a symmetry that forbids that aside from saying, well, I. So, okay, so hang on. So the, yeah, I mean, there's like a dark, yeah.
I guess like a mixed quartic could always be forbidden by locality. If this is like if the UV scenario is an extra dimension,
so right. So the let's talk about this later because I just want to think about it a bit more. So the other model that we looked at is essentially a dark QCD sector. The dark sector has an SUN and U1 gauge symmetry. You have the opposite process. Your dark charge pions are stabilized by a residual symmetry, but your dark neutral pion can decay to dark photons very similarly to the standard model neutral pion. In this case, the splitting between these states is radiative. It comes from the charge carried by the charge pions. It just gets set by the coupling and the scales of the dark sector. So now in this case, the CMB constraints are important because you don't exponentially suppress them. So here's part of the parameter space. This is G prime. This is the coupling in the dark. This is the U1 coupling in the dark sector versus the mass of the dark pions. So in this case, you see, I advertise this as a way to get sub GeV thermal dark matter. But this particular model and these particular parameters, you can move the CMB constraint down from about 30 GeV to about 1 GeV, but it's hard to go smaller than that. But that ratio is entirely just set by how small you made your mass splitting. If you make your mass splitting smaller, you can relax the CMB constraint further. Again, other direct detection bounds from dwarf galaxies and from our galaxy are similarly suppressed by the small phase space factor. Okay, so I'll just sum up there. So there are many ways, many of which I didn't talk about here, to get thermal dark matter into the MeV to GeV range. I hope I've shown you that just simple kinematics is one way to do that. Forbidden dark matter models allow you to suppress annihilation. That suppression can be partly lifted by the presence of many to two channels. Even in simple dark photon models, there's a parameter regime where the dark photon and dark matter mass are similar, where 3-2 annihilations dominate freeze-out. Such models get you lower dark matter masses for given couplings. They strongly alleviate or completely destroy limits from indirect detection. And they can also possess potentially interesting self-interaction cross-sections. If you've got near degeneracy between the dark matter and its annihilation product, that's another way to kill the indirect detection signals at late times, for light, while also getting the right thermal relic density for couplings which are not particularly large or not particularly small. So while searching for light dark matter models, these are some examples of ways to get a cosmology that works and gives you thermal relics in a simple manner. Okay, thanks very much, and again thanks very much to the organizers of the conference. and to all of you for coming. I've really enjoyed the last few days. Somebody go for that.
Yeah, so can you go back to the exclusion size for the forbidden dark matter?
Not forbidden?
Yeah.
This one? Yeah.
So if you're saying the purple band is the preferred range, if you say that this can help the structure formation,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
So since you have this resonance effect on the dark photon, maybe you can have velocity dependent self-interaction as well.
So at least for this, so this self-interaction is maybe when you get very close to maybe when you get very close to R goes to 2, then maybe you can get a velocity-dependent effect. I mean, for most of the parameter space, this is approximately velocity-independent. You don't get something like the Sommerfeld enhancement because the dark photon is at the same mass scale as the dark matter. So So I mean, the resonance comes from the fact that total mass in the incoming particles is similar to total mass in the outgoing particles. So if you're close enough to that being true, that your kinetic energy between being in a dwarf and being in the galaxy cluster makes the difference between whether you're on that resonance or not, then it's going to be pretty fine-tuned to do that. So you need to be very close. So in most of the parameter space, this particular thing doesn't naturally give you velocity dependent scattering.
And also for this, when you estimate the kinetic equilibrium, you just compare the scatter to the Hubble, right?
That's right. Okay,
yeah.
That's right.
Because could three body annihilations be important at least then?
So.
Because then they could cool the halo.
Yeah, so I've actually been thinking a bit about this, mostly because in the course of teaching a student how to use a code, they computed the boost factors and the effects on the CMB for 3 and 4 body annihilation. So this is a calculation that I have, and I'm trying to see if there's any use for it. So I mean, the basic problem is the densities in the late universe are pretty small compared to densities in the early universe, this is a strong function of the dark matter mass too. As you go to lighter dark matter, both your number density gets higher, and you also freeze out happens at later times. So the density it frees out is closer to the density in the late universe. But of course, for thermal very light dark matter, there are other difficulties that you run into. Once below an MeV, you have to seriously worry about an effect of below a KeV, you have to seriously worry about warm dark matter baths. But so your question is, in something like, the point of these is they're super sensitive to density. So if you had something like a dark matter spike around a black hole, or if you had very dense little microhalos scattered through the halo, and people have talked about these ultra-dense microhalos, in those circumstances, this is something that I'm looking at a little bit at the moment, just to see, could you potentially get signals there without lighting up gamma ray point sources all over the, or
well,
lighting
we're
up gamma ray X-ray point sources all over the
three
sky.
Particles of average velocity come in.
Yeah.
Two come out cold. One comes out hot. It leaves the system.
Mm. Okay. So you're interested in evaporation. Through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then what they would do is cool it.
Yeah.
And then you avoid the problem of you have an initial state with two cold ones and one hot one, and they combine three average ones. Because you kick out product ones.
Hmm.
And maybe, the density in the halo is too low for this to be important. But as you remarked, there are some situations where people involve large dark matter density. And if that were true, then that would potentially overcool too much and could collapse.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. We can look into it. Yeah, I mean, it's the basic problem is that if you write down typical dark matter densities of the halo in terms of the mass scale of the dark matter, you get fantastic. And you're talking about heavier than KeV dark matter, then you get extremely low numbers, and every extra power of that really drops the rate by a lot. But if you have regions of if you have regions of sufficiently high density. You know, I'll think about that. That's an interesting
thing. A related thing I've never been able to figure out how to do, but maybe somebody here knows what to do, is think back to Spergel Steinhardt. I'm changing the subject a little bit.
Sure.
Think back to Spergel Steinhardt, the self-interacting dark matter. And you remember how infuriated you felt when you read that paper
that
I cannot limit this in any way, because it has no visible particles connected to it. It's just elastic scattering of things I can't detect.
Yeah.
But that elastic scattering cross-section is huge. So one thing I've long wondered about is three-body scattering. Mm. Again, where two leaf cold, one leaf hot, and leaves the system.
Okay.
Would that cause problems? But I don't know how to calculate three processes. Apparently you do.
Yeah, so okay, because some... Well, sorry, do you want to comment on that?
We're doing some N-body simulations in London, nuclear dark matter, where we look at the effect of hot particles leaving the system where you get composite dark matter.
Ah.
The effect it has on the structures. And it makes things more cuspy.
Okay,
well,
so you can constrain.
But that's the simple situation. You can go into a different kinematic regime and you can imagine it making it things less cuspy. But it also only has an effect, it depends on your Q value as well, so it will only have an effect on certain halos.
So here I'm talking about doing it by elastic scattering, just using the fact that the cross section may invoke the bond for 2-2. So I always wondered about 3-3.
Hmm.
The other question, you mentioned some of the BBN type limits.
Yeah.
I guess you. Did you see or take into account those Nillet Steinman papers on low mass dark matter and if it couples only to the M sector or if it couples only to the neutrino sector?
Yeah, so well, we didn't really look below the MeV scale here.
Okay.
We said, okay, for these papers we said we're going to stay above the MeV scale for a couple of reasons. One is that as you saw, even at 10^8, because we're invoking dark photons in all of these models, the dark photon parameter space is extremely constrained in that region.
Is that
the
mass has to be greater than about an MeV, roughly
speaking,
to avoid, in either scenario, to avoid jump.
So there's this recent,
an implied tilde there. Right.
Yeah, sure. So there's this. Right, so this is just making the statement that in effect
it
constraints
is
strange. I think I've seen there are a bunch of papers on it. There are some caveats on this, right? Like there was this recent Berlin paper where he was looking at the case where the dark matter sort of where the coupling between the dark sector and the standard model is going through a decay or something, and so you like couple. You first couple after BBN, and then you decouple before the CMB time. And so, in that case, you can have caveats. But yeah, I agree. I mean, if something has been coupled to the standard model and is in thermal equilibrium for a long time and is still in thermal equilibrium after the QCD phase transition, and you're below an MeV, then I think you're fairly screwed at BBN. I mean, either you still have the light degree of freedom around, or it decays and heats up neutrinos or photons relative to each other, and then that also messes with an effector.
If it's a one scalar and it's in thermal equilibrium,
then it's just okay. Because you can squeeze in the 1 degree of freedom.
A few hundred kV can tolerate it.
Right. Yeah, but if you want to deal with fermions or vectors which have more degrees of freedom, then it's very hard. No, I mean, that's my understanding, that if you want to have thermal dark matter below an MeV, you have to, it has to only have just coupled or never be fully in thermal equilibrium or something along those lines.
So with regard to this question about neutrinos and being in thermal equilibrium, so the CMB bounds in the usual case where you're annihilating a mass scattering way out of equilibrium, there's usually some efficiency factor based on what or not, what final states you're going into. But I'm wondering, is there something we could do with the CMB in the case where you're annihilating the neutrinos? Because they're coming out very boosted.
Yeah.
Even though neutrinos are decoupled, if it's like, say, a GeV scale deposition.
So like just from the fact that you have extra dark radiation, or you want to look at the neutrino interactions with the mass? Like you want to look at how neutrinos heat up the matter. So I mean, there, like in the analyses I did of the efficiency factors, I took the easy route out and was like, okay, I'm going to set all the neutrino efficiency factors to zero, which is okay. It's probably not true in detail, but there are 5 to 10% errors everywhere in that calculation. And I was pretty sure that neutrinos were not going to have an efficiency factor. So it's only in the case where you go 100% to neutrinos. I mean, I think it's fair. I mean, the universe is, I'm pretty sure the universe is still transparent, is still pretty transparent, very transparent to GeV neutrinos injected at the surface of last scattering. So I'd imagine that they drop it, that they deposit. I mean, yeah, so I mean, if you're talking about really light dark matter and S-wave annihilation or Sommerfeld enhanced annihilation, so the rates are huge, then maybe it's okay if only a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the neutrinos ever hit anything. I mean, maybe you can still set a bound, but I suspect, yeah, I mean, maybe if you're in a mass region where, I mean, like Super K can't see it and it's really hard to see those neutrinos any other way, maybe you can do something competitive. I suspect that if there's any other meaningful bet, it will tend to win over looking for the 1 in a billion neutrinos that hit something this time. I mean, I could be wrong. I haven't actually tried to calculate it. I just looked at the size of the cross sections and went, okay, no, just going to ignore that one. Okay, well, thank you again. Thank you.